Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver, and I'm here with Rick Phillips, and this is the Catastrophic Health Matters Show. Now, again, by catastrophic, Rick, the Webster's definition of catastrophic
This is the only way we ever do Health Matters.
I know. I agree. But this is involving or causing great damage or suffering.
Well, that's the definition of Health Matters.
Right. Extremely unfortunate or unsuccessful.
Well, I mean,
sounds appropriate as well. Now, here's the reason we decided to call this the Catastrophic Health Matters. I did. All right, fine. If you want to back out,
I agree with you, but okay, I didn't get any input.
Because this is going to be a great name, and you wish that you had been a part of it. This was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine back, I think it was the July issue. They recruited 33 volunteers. These were highly educated people, computer literate people, and they set them on the healthcare.gov website and watched as they tried to purchase insurance on the healthcare.gov website. And they ran into problems. There were a bewildering variety of questions of benefits, of terms, and so forth. One of them said, I would love a tool where it's like, is it important that you have dental coverage? Check this box. Do you want mental health coverage? Check this box. And have it generate a group of plans that would be right for you. Of course, in healthcare.gov's defense, the site didn't even work last November, so that would be a pretty big jump to go from not working to being able to offer individual plans. One of the problems, again, was they didn't know the terms, the PPOs, HMOs, HSAs, what's the difference between a deductible and a copay. And one of the things they mentioned was that there are these catastrophic healthcare plans. So, you know, when you say that, you think, well, gee, I'm not sure. Rick, would you like to purchase a catastrophic? I have a catastrophic plan here. Would you like to be a part of it?
Let me think. No.
No, it needs a new name. Who would buy a catastrophic healthcare plan?
I think we understand what they're getting at, right? I mean, they're talking about trying to cover you in the event of a catastrophic healthcare issue.
Right.
Something like a major surgery or cancer or something like that. But gosh, we all wish for that.
Right. Open enrollment for healthcare.gov ended March 31st. It starts back November 15th. So you've got some time in between where you can study and look at your options, and then maybe you'll be able to figure it out when you go back November 15th. But a catastrophic healthcare plan requires you to pay all of your medical costs up to a certain amount, and that's usually several thousand dollars. And after you reach that, then you are able to, the essential
not
health benefits
anymore.
Yeah, are paid by the plan. Now, it also, though, even the catastrophic healthcare plan, they cover 3 primary care visits per year at no cost, even before the deductible is met, and they also cover free preventive services because every plan on the healthcare.gov site has to cover free preventive services. And they are generally for people with what's called a hardship exemption, and this are people that there are 14 types of hardship exemptions, including cancellation of your previous plan and not able to afford a new plan.
Now, did you notice that, Tony? 14.
14.
Not 10. You know, 14. Some weird random number that actually works with their... You know,
I hear you, Rick. Life doesn't always come in multiples of 10. I'm trying to do better.
We at Health Matters, we do everything we can count in multiples of 5 because that's how many fingers and toes we have.
Right. But they did have 14 types of hardship exemptions that may allow you to buy a catastrophic plan. But these catastrophic plans, again, the idea is you're a healthy person. You're probably not going to need much health care services. You get your 3 primary care visits, your preventative service visits, and that's probably all you're going to need this year. Then take a chance if you have, again, if you are part of these hardship exemptions, and buy yourself a catastrophic plan. That's what they're about, but experts agree we're probably going to have to change the name of a catastrophic health care plan.
Yeah, I don't think they sell catastrophic insurance, you know, for your house. I mean, I think so. There's
not for very long.
Or your automobile policy isn't right. I think, you know, we are talking about insurance here, and everybody, you know, sometimes we do talk about, you know, the healthcare part of it creeps deeper in than probably should. But I mean, in a sense, this is insurance, and the insurance business has been around a long time. I can't believe they kind of got these names all messed up.
I agree.
And maybe they don't think they're messed up.
Well, I really think after looking at this, this was really the first time that there was any research done. It's only 33 people, but they did look at the healthcare.gov site, and they got some pretty good suggestions for how to make it better when the next open enrollment occurs, and that'll be November 15th of this year,
frankly,
for the 2015 season.
I think they shouldn't use such big words.
Agreed.
I mean, you know, because gosh forbid if you have to, you know, how many times are the website guys going to have to do spell check?
Right.
And because that's an easy one to misspell.
And it needs to be more user-friendly. I mean, pretty much everything you do needs to be more user-friendly. And I'm sure you've heard that over and over again as a technology, of technology.
You know, that's funny too, Tony, because that stuff has come a long way and it has become a lot more user-friendly. Things have become more intuitive as we get deeper and deeper into using computers. It's interesting how that's evolved.
Right. And speaking of catastrophes, can you explain to our radio fans where they would find us on the internet?
If you want to go find the mega load of Health Matters catastrophes, jump on over to WMKY.org. You have to do just a little bit of digging. There's a couple of menus there, and you have to find Health Matters. But eventually, you will find the page that promotes this show, and we will use the word promote. Basically, there's a show summary there for the most recent shows. You can download the audio. You can sign up for the podcast. There's a lot to do there. Jump on over to WMKY.org. Certainly take a look around. After you're done, jump on Facebook. Interact with the show. That is how we allow participation in the show. You can jump online, you can leave feedback, you can leave comments. Check out some of the posts that go up there. I mean, Tony does a good job of posting stuff up there. I've seen several in the last few weeks that are very timely, very relevant. Some of them are healthcare. Most of them are healthcare. Some of them are just us being us. I mean, that's just the way we are. Anybody who listens knows sometimes we just have to step up on a soapbox or we see something that's fascinating. But that all happens at facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's show, the Disease of the Month Club. This month's disease, Alzheimer's disease. Their motto, Alzheimer's disease, what's that motto again? And our top 10 fun facts about Alzheimer's disease.
Now see, Tony, you do this to me because one of our very first shows was on Alzheimer's, and I made jokes, and I got in trouble.
That's right.
And so you picked a topic that I am not allowed to joke with.
And I presented 10 fun facts. I thought about crossing out one, and I said, no, just let Rick's do. That's what
you're going to do. So for 10 times, never mind.
Fun facts about Alzheimer's disease. Number one, discovered more than 100 years ago, Dr. Alois Alzheimer noted changes in the brain tissue of a woman who had died of an unusual mental illness. He described the clumps, which are now amyloid plaques, the tangled bundles of fibers, now neurofibrillary tangles, that are characteristic of Alzheimer's disease 100 years ago. Number two, it's the sixth leading cause of death in America. More than 5 million Americans and 8 million more people worldwide. Now, think about that fun fact, Rick, because I think there is something wrong there. It affects more than 5 million Americans and more than 8 million other people worldwide. And America is not 5/8 of the world's population.
No, I was sitting there getting ready to do the math on that. But, nope. You know, what, 300 to 350 million in a population of 7 billion?
We are diagnosing it more than other countries. I don't think that we are an epicenter of an Alzheimer's epidemic.
I think we're just more diagnosed.
I believe so. I picked up these facts. Actually, we presented them uncritically last time we had this sponsor, but I'm more critical this time.
How many of the undeveloped countries may not live to the age to where it presents itself?
Fair enough. I give you that. By the way, speaking of life expectancy,
I just get something halfway right, maybe?
Maybe, but right now there is a political turmoil over what to do with these children that are coming up from Central America, specifically from Honduras and other countries in Central America, and they are fleeing life-threatening situations. They may be refugees. They may be taking advantage of the system. They may be both, and they're obviously a very difficult political problem. I don't want to get into the politics, but I just looked, Rick, at the life expectancy in Honduras.
Okay.
The life expectancy for men in Honduras is 69 years of age. In the U.S. in general, it's about 79. In parts of eastern Kentucky, it's 66.
Wow.
So, you know,
you'll lose 3 years.
Right. And so the question is, should we maybe be sending Perry County, Floyd County kids to Honduras to improve their life expectancy?
Yeah, it sounds good and it's kind of funny, but you know, the quality of life's probably different.
It is different, but it just points out, you know, when you talk about these horrendous situations these young children are fleeing, and that is no joke. And then you look at, whether you die of overdose or whether you die of gang violence or terrorist attack, you're still dead. And unfortunately, we have some places near us whose life expectancy is less than the place these children are coming from, which is shocking. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of alarming when you think about it, because we do develop those numbers in aggregate, and, you know, here especially here in Eastern Kentucky, they're bad. And you know, they're going to move here. They're going to learn 28% of them are going to start smoking. They're going to start developing diabetes. Or, I mean, it's going to be.
And they're going to have an overdose in their 20s. It's quite possible.
Absolutely.
All right, fun fact number three. We staying with Alzheimer's. Kentucky has 80,000 people with Alzheimer's disease or had in 2010, and that number is rising fairly rapidly. Number four, 1 in 8 people age 65 and older, and nearly half the people over age 85 have Alzheimer's disease. Age is a primary risk factor. That's fun fact number five for Alzheimer's disease. And again, it doubles every 5 years for people over age 65. And when you get to your mid-80s, 1 in 2 of people are affected by Alzheimer's disease. Number six, it is unusual for it to occur before age 60, but 4% of people do have it before age 65. Number seven, 1 in 3 seniors dies with it. Number eight, almost 2/3 of Americans with Alzheimer's disease are women. Our argument, Rick, is always men are too stupid to live long enough to have Alzheimer's disease. There is not a superior protection of the male brain or superior education. It's just simply, I think most of the guys, either they don't, you can't tell it because they're...
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I'm not sure my wife will be able to tell when I come down with Alzheimer's.
My family has already said that to me. And number 10, in 2012, 15.4 million caregivers provided 175 billion hours of unpaid care. That is, it is a drain not only on the person who gets it, but also on the family. We've got some information from the International Alzheimer's Association meeting. This was in Europe. This was in Copenhagen. And I've got three articles for our next fractional portion on that, but we did want to give you those fun facts on Alzheimer's disease. I got a little bit of time. Okay. I have a little bit of time.
You do have a little bit, but you're not going to have enough to do what you want to do.
I know, but we'll start on it anyway. Case report from France. A 74-year-old man with asthma was burning leaves, which is always a bad... I mean...
Same thing you do with a cigarette.
Right. How bad is this? He's burning leaves and he has asthma when he heard an explosion and felt something pierce the right side of his chest. Now, Rick, just as a homeowner and as a male, how many times have you started off doing something and heard the explosion? I'm thinking, well, every day in my life, that's
not every day, but I'd be lying if I said it never happened.
Yeah.
I had a fireplace insert one time and I decided to set a can of, I think it was like for dusting, you know, mm-hmm. the Pledge or something like that.
Right.
And I set a can on that and I realized the fireplace insert was warmer than the room because it had fire going in it. And the can literally exploded into the top of the ceiling. It was excellent.
What male among us has not, at one point in your life, heard an explosion that was related to something that you did? I was thinking, I've got two explosions that I heard as a part of everyday activity that I caused. And so that's a question. You have not lived till you've caused at least one explosion. But we're going to tell you why that explosion happened, where it came from, and why it made Health Matters in our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is a second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Catastrophic Health Matters Show.
And catastrophic. We were talking about some of the explosions during the break.
Yes, we have been a part of many homeowner explosions between the two of us.
And the thing is how many of them were there people standing around watching, like starting a fire?
Yeah.
You know, I have a 12-acre, you know, little mini farm thing, and every once in a while I'll have the kids over for a bonfire or something like that, and who doesn't want to start a fire with gasoline?
Rapidly. You want to mess around for 15 minutes waiting for the thing to ignite.
Let's get this party started.
I need a fire. I need it now.
Right? The Black Eyed Peas got it right. Let's get it started.
What could possibly go wrong? Our sponsor for first of all, the show itself, we remind you that the healthcare.gov definition of catastrophic is a high deductible plan that still pays for 3 primary care visits a year plus preventative maintenance. Then after that, you're on the hook for all your healthcare expenses that year up to a very high deductible, generally several $1,000s. They are very, very cheap. You have to have a hardship exemption, one of 14, to be able to purchase those. And you can shop those when the open enrollment reopens November 15th of 2014. But in the meantime, understand that from a healthcare standpoint, catastrophic is a type of insurance plan and not necessarily a natural disaster such as the ones that Rick and I have both caused diagnosed and experienced. Our sponsor for the second time, Alzheimer's Disease, the Disease of the Month Club. Alzheimer's Disease, their motto. Alzheimer's Disease, what is that motto again? The... Sorry. There was an Alzheimer's Association International Conference in Copenhagen, and they reported out several articles from that on the 15th of July. One of those pointed out that the risk of developing Alzheimer's appears to be dropping. The Framingham study, which is in Framingham, Massachusetts, and was primarily designed to look at heart disease and heart disease risk factors, they started tracking new dementia cases among people ages 60 and older back in 1978 and have compared their risks over the years. What they found was that new cases were 22% lower in 1989, they were 38% lower in 1996, and 44% lower in 2006. The average age where dementia was diagnosed rose from 80 in the first period to 85 in the last one. And this probably does not, if you think about it, represent a change in our ability to diagnose Alzheimer's. It more likely represents an actual change in the incidence. Declines in smoking, heart disease, and strokes, which are factors that are related to dementia, a rise in people using blood pressure medicines, and those getting more education may have contributed to it. The prevalence declined dramatically in women, a smaller decline in men.
No.
As no. always. Germany also saw a decline. In Africa, there appears to be an increase in Alzheimer's disease, possibly due to diagnosis, possibly due to increased longevity, possibly due to other risk factors. One thing about developing countries is they are learning the bitter lessons of poor nutrition and smoking that we have learned in the U.S., and so they may be behind us for that reason.
Let me tell you what, 20 years ago when the cigarette thing started its wave, if you didn't get rid of all your cigarette company stocks, you were crazy. To me, this is only a matter of time before the huge boom in China and India don't start tailing off, you know? At some point, they're going to figure out we made mistakes.
Yeah, probably so, but I think in the meantime, you can have a very, very healthy retirement off cigarette money.
I guess
they are
true.
Making out like bandits worldwide, and they've used some of the U.S. trade agreements to push their products into Asia and into other places.
It's kind of funny how, you know, it was so important to us home, but we don't really care as long as we're making something on the exports, do we? It's tough. It's a tough place to be. And believe me, we are right here in the middle of still, you know, there's still a lot of tobacco grown here in this region.
Yeah. A fraction of what we have, but still, from as far as U.S. tobacco, we still grow quite a bit of it here in Kentucky.
You know, it's been 10 years since the buyout, the settlement, since they basically the government came in and offered to buy out everybody's bases. It's hard to believe it's been 10 years, Tony.
Tobacco barns are falling in. We have noticed a reduction in our production here.
What were we talking about again?
Oh, yeah. All right. So back to the first. And this is the thing. You hear an explosion, and we sort of forget about it, right? Because after all, we have heard so many explosions. Yes, there was an explosion. A 74-year-old asthmatic man, for an inexplicable reason, was burning leaves. When he heard an explosion, something pierced the right side of his chest. At the hospital, the doctors found an entry wound between his ribs on the right side, but no exit wound. Whatever the exploding thing was, in fact, still lodged inside the man.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, so was
here
this a terrorist attack? Was this ordnance? Was this some type of space dust? Was it, in fact, an alien creature?
No.
All these possibilities. No, in fact, what it was, after they got the x-rays, they concluded he had an inhaler stuck in his chest.
Impaled.
Impaled in his, an impaler inhaler.
An impaled inhaler.
And what had happened, apparently, he had this inhaler in his shirt pocket because, after all, when you're burning leaves, it is quite possible you could trigger an asthma attack. The inhaler fell into the burning leaves.
Oh, no.
And
exploded.
These inhalers, they have medicine in them to treat asthma, but they also have a gas that pushes it. When you puff on it, it pushes it into your lungs. And that propellant gas expanded and exploded the inhaler, and it lodged in his chest. They did decide they were going to remove it.
That would have made a pretty big hole, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think so. An inhaler, it's a size.
That's a quarter.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking.
The size of a quarter.
Quarter to a half-dollar sized canister, so it's a cylinder, and the cross-section of it would look like a quarter
to a half-dollar.
And
if it exploded, there had to be a blowout in it somewhere, which probably helped it get through the skin. This is worse and worse the more I find out.
This is I think so. They show a picture of it. They're lodged. It was between his liver and his diaphragm. It didn't touch a blood vessel or a key nerve, and they were able to surgically remove the inhaler, which they decided to do. Sometimes you leave stuff in. They were not going to leave an exploded inhaler.
The size of an inhaler, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. And
we were talking about a quarter. we're talking about the diameter. But right. the thing itself is about 3 to 4 inches long.
Yeah, it looks like maybe a pill bottle. It would be the way I would describe
now,
it. About the size
of a small
pill bottle.
They have a plastic top on them, so I suspect that probably burned off, and it was probably just the canister.
We posted this, by the way, on our Facebook page. So those of you who follow Health Matters by Facebook, and we thank both of you for doing that, you probably got a chance to see this
I
picture.
I think we're up to 3 or 4 now.
Maybe so, but the point is, you already had a head start on the rest of the guys. Amuse and amaze your friends during the break. You can tell what the Health Matters second fractional portion story is going to be about. But at any rate, they did. They took the inhaler out, and this is a reminder that the warnings on the inhaler say to keep it away from heat and flame, and I'm sure he never thought about that when he went out to burn leaves. An exploding inhaler, though, is one, apparently, of the side effects of your asthma treatment. Now, next up is, Rick, something that I know that you have spent a great deal of your early career about, and this is people catching fire in the hospital. A very annoying thing. And they even describe this, the story I got here, which was posted July 12th in Modern Healthcare. This was June 2013. A man who arrived in an emergency room in North Carolina needed an immediate tracheostomy. That is, his tongue had swelled shut from an allergic reaction. He could not breathe, so they had to make an incision in his neck. This is where they plunged the knife into
his
neck.
This is where you use a straw in your MacGyver.
Yeah, that's right. So the surgeon was standing there. They had to do this immediately because he couldn't breathe. They couldn't put a tube down to help him breathe because his tongue was blocking off his air. So they cut into it. They splashed him with an alcohol-based antiseptic. They cut open his neck so that they could make an airway for him. And when they cut it open, it started bleeding. They used an electrocautery device. It's called a Bovi to buzz the blood vessels and to coagulate them so they wouldn't bleed. Now, the problem is when you use an electrical device and they used an alcohol antiseptic, if you don't let the alcohol dry, you ignite the alcohol. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, Tony, you know, just for our listeners, the way a what's commonly referred to as a Bovi, and that Bovi is actually the original company that made them. What it does is it creates an arc of electricity between ground, which you put a ground on the patient. And so the patient has electrical ground hooked to them, and this electrode actually arcs a little basic electrical arc across the skin, and that's what creates the cauterization.
It zaps the blood vessels with a little tiny lightning bolt.
But it is absolutely a lightning bolt, and it's absolutely capable of starting a nice fire if there's something around.
You know, and the point is that they pointed out that this is something that is very preventable. You've got to let the alcohol stuff dry. There appears to be a decrease in operating room fires, although, interestingly enough, you don't have to report how many patients caught fire in your hospital last year. There is no national reporting data bank that says we had this many patient fires.
Well, but you do have to put sponge counts in there.
Yeah.
You have to actually count the sponges in the room so that you make sure you go out with the same number you came in with.
Right. There's a lot of things you have to report. But
not fires.
People catching on fires, not one of them. They estimate about 240 nationwide down
from... Would
that
qualify as catastrophic?
Well, that's why I put it in. You see, we've got explosions, and we got people catching fire. Very annoying thing to have happen to you or someone you love while you're in the hospital. Now, I remember when we started using these alcohol-based hand sanitizers, experts thought we were going to have a rash of hospital fires.
Yeah.
And
they
evaporate
pretty quick.
We didn't.
Well, we also did the same thing with cell phones years ago. We thought, cell phones were going to be... The RF emitted from them were going to cause a lot of problems with the equipment. It turns out it wasn't as big a deal as we thought. Although, there were issues at the beginning.
Yeah, but I think it's just a reminder again to our radio fans. We've seen it time and time again. If you put a spray on the skin, you know, we had the grill that caught fire to the guy who had sprayed himself with bug spray. I remember very distinctly a case report of a guy who was using coal tar to treat a skin condition, and he went outside to smoke, and he caught his coal tar cream on fire. And the letter to the editor of the AMA Journal, it began, "A man was observed in the courtyard bursting into flames," which I think is one of the best scientific letters I've ever heard.
But, and survived.
Yeah, but just remember this. One, Rick and I have both seen explosions coming from people using oxygen, home oxygen, and standing by a stove or around a fire. And it is theoretically possible, although I have never seen it, for alcohol, hand sanitizer to catch fire, and other sprays you put on your skin to catch fire. Please let them dry before you approach an open flame.
Tony, I tell you what, man, an oxygen concentrator. Years ago, we had a rash of, you know, Eastern Kentucky is full of smokers. A lot of people smoke in the house where you've got an oxygen-enriched environment. And we would try to tell people the dangers of doing that. And you know what we finally did? We finally just made a video. Me and at the time my boss, Hal Bledsoe, we got outside on the back porch of St. Clair in a nice safe area. We were plenty away. And we took an oxygen concentrator with about a 10-foot hose on it. And we literally started a fire at the end of it. It was like a torch. It looked just like something you'd be trying to weld with or trying to, you know, use a cutting torch. And it was amazing how that little bit of oxygen coming out of that tube created such a powerful flame. So, I mean, I'm telling you, you get into these oxygen-enriched environments, fire is a huge, huge potential problem.
So summer is time for grilling. It's time for bonfires. It's time for open flames. Remember, any type of spray may have a flammable propellant. You've got to look at those things. And in this case, the asthma inhaler, and then secondly, the alcohol skin sanitizer. Both of these things caught fire with really disastrous results for the people
involved. The interesting thing about the inhaler, though, the inhaler really wasn't doing anything until it was dropped in the fire.
Yeah, you wonder, you know, and I don't want to make suggestions here, but basically, if you took some type of a tube and an inhaler and a match, just exactly what you could come up with. This would be a MacGyver. You remember, I did not know that you could create a blowtorch with hairspray until James Bond did it.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, we've all done that.
Absolutely. And so now the question, you know, is you think, I have some inhalers at home.
The question is how many eyebrows did you lose?
Yeah.
How many eyebrows?
Yeah, this one I'm afraid of. I have tried spray blowtorch, but I don't think I'll be setting fire to any inhalers anytime soon. Please, ladies and gentlemen, radio fans all over the world,
do not try this
at home. A bad idea. Now, no one caught fire, which is, I guess, a little disappointing, but this is still something that our radio fans need to be aware of. This was a case report in the July issue of Pediatrics.
Okay.
Actually, it's their August issue, which was released in July. It was an 11-year-old boy, and he had had skin allergies all of his life. But he developed, over a period of 6 months, a more aggressive skin allergy. His skin was raised, red, itchy, and it was different from his typical pattern. He went to an allergist, and they tested him, and he had an allergy to nickel. And that's a very common allergy, nickel in a lot of types of jewelry, some types of piercing and so forth. And they went to what they called an avoidance session, trying to figure out, they figured this kid was getting his hands on nickel, and the nickel was going all over his body, and they were trying to figure it out. It turns out that his family had purchased a first-generation iPad back in 2010, and he had been using it more and more over the past 6 months before his rash started to flare up. They tested the iPad. It did test positive for nickel, and several Apple products do, and he was instructed, they put it in one of the smart cases, which would cover the entire iPad, so that he could not get his hands on the nickel, and his rash improved dramatically in his follow-up visit.
Death by iPad.
Yeah, well, the thing is, in this case, he would get trace amounts of nickel on his hands, and then wherever his hands went, it's sort of like poison ivy at that point, wherever he maintained contact, he would, in fact, develop this rash. So he had an all-over body rash that was coming from regular use of an iPad that had nickel in the case of the iPad. So those really slick metal cases. Now, I don't know about other brands, but Apple products with the metal cases do have trace amounts of nickel in them, and apparently that's enough to trigger an allergy in some people.
That's a weird one, Tony. You would have never guessed those pretty metal designs. I would have not thought there would have been nickel in those.
It's interesting because most of the nickel rashes I've seen is a belt buckle. That's the most common thing I've seen. Occasionally, you'll get a ring or a piece of jewelry that's cheap and has nickel in it. Because most jewelry now, they try to avoid it because they know it can trigger allergies.
I wonder if anybody's ever actually gotten an old coin that was actually made out of nickel. Gotten a rash from it. I would say there probably is, but yeah. That has happened.
But the most common are that sort of thing, and I had not seen this. And the other thing is the method. I mean, like I said, a belt buckle is very simple. If you get a red rash around the belt buckle area, that's pretty much, there's
checkmate.
Nothing else that would do that. Yeah. But in this case, this was a pretty generalized rash. Apparently,
think about it, because you're holding the iPad, and then, you know, who knows what you're touching.
Right. And apparently he held it enough that he transferred nickel to his hands and got a generalized rash.
Wow.
Got a couple minutes here. This is going to be a little bit more complicated, but I want people to be aware of it.
So, yeah, let's only do it in 2.5 minutes.
We can do anything.
Catastrophe.
Listen, if I can create blow torches and you can blow up things, we can easily take care of this. This was published July 3rd. In the AMA Journal of Surgery, and they looked at those Da Vinci robots. You remember the Da Vinci robots. This was the height of surgical technology. There were billboards around most towns touting which hospital had the Da Vinci surgical robot, and they were using that for prostate surgery and other types of surgeries. One of the problems with this Da Vinci robot, one of the things that our radio fans need to be aware of, the company that made it promoted it very aggressively. They targeted certain surgeons. They tried to increase the number of surgeries they want. They set quotas, and they offered incentives to try to get people to use the robot more, which was unethical, and that behavior got them into quite a bit of trouble.
Yeah, but let's be honest. I mean, the marketing behind a robot, there are certain microsurgeries that you have to do where you have to be very precise, very small movements. And the idea of using a robot with a microscope, you know, or some kind of a magnification system sounds like a great idea, right? I mean, it just seems like that would be the right way to go.
Right. And there's a couple of problems. One
but
is
wait.
You have to learn the technique, and it takes a while to learn it. And the company pushed very aggressively to try to push this technique out. And then secondly, you lose the sense of touch. You can't tell whether the thing you're touching is very delicate, or all you do is you see it on a screen. Well, there was a group that looked at the Health Research and Quality's nationwide inpatient sample, 400,000 patients who underwent prostate surgery between January of 2003 and December of 2009. 80% of them had the robotic procedure, 20% had traditional surgery. And here's something you got to think about when you hear information about robotic surgery. The people that had the robot procedure were more likely to be white, more likely to have it in higher income areas, and had fewer other illnesses. So anytime someone says, oh, the science says that that robot really has great outcomes, you've got to realize when that science is based on a kind of a skewed population that got the robot in the first place.
Right.
We're going to talk more about this robot and why we are interested in it in our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters, the Catastrophic Show on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. This is it, Tony.
This is
the last one.
This is the end of our catastrophic Health Matters show. Our sponsor for the final time, the Disease of the Month Club, this month's disease, Alzheimer's disease.
Are you sure it's the final time?
Reminding you, Alzheimer's disease, our motto, what is that motto again? we talked about our fun facts about Alzheimer's disease. We talked about this meeting in Copenhagen where there was quite a bit of evidence produced, first of all, that said that our rates of Alzheimer's disease are dropping. And again, the thinking right now is that if we treat high blood pressure and cardiac conditions aggressively, if we educate ourselves, then we may, in fact, be able to lower our risk of Alzheimer's disease. There were a couple of other things reported. First, from Stephanie Schultz, University of Wisconsin in Madison. They have the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, and they have a Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention. They call it the RAP.
Nice.
Yeah, I like that.
I would hope.
Yeah, they had 1,500 participants. They looked at 329 of them who had completed a cognitive activity scale, and also they'd ask them questions about playing games. We specifically focused on playing games such as cards, checkers, crosswords, and other puzzles because those are cognitively stimulating games.
Are you a gamer?
You know,
just answer.
Yeah, I know. I'm thinking about it. Yeah, in some ways.
Trying to rationalize it, then no.
Yeah, we'll do the National Public Radio Puzzler every Sunday morning. My wife loves Sudoku. She does them all the time.
I didn't say your wife. I know.
And I do some on my computer. I'll do Trivial Pursuit and a few things like that. I don't sit still long enough. That's my problem.
Yep. I can see that with you.
Yeah.
You like being outside blowing things up.
Yeah, why would you do an intellectually stimulating game when you can create an explosion in your backyard?
I am really surprised that you use a chainsaw on your trees. I don't know why you just don't dynamite them down.
It would speed things up a little bit, wouldn't it? Back to the study. The average age there was 60 years old. 60 years old. Think about that. And they were at increased risk for Alzheimer's disease. Three-quarters of them had at least one parent with Alzheimer's disease. 40% had that ApoE4, which increases your risk. They had several associations. First of all, what about the game players? What if you did an MRI scan of their brain? They had larger regions in the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is associated with memory. And it was a little bit larger in people who played the games. Frequent game players had higher scores on verbal learning and immediate memory when they did their test. And this is one characteristic of Alzheimer's patients, which drives people nuts. They have, in many cases, intact memory for very far distant events, but their recent memory is really bad. So they can remember things from their childhood, but they cannot remember where they ate dinner yesterday. So game playing appeared to be associated with increased brain volume and also had higher scores on memory in that. Now, the problem is, and people mention that, first of all, which comes first? Do you people with bigger brains may play more games? games. So rather than saying game playing enlarges your brain, it may be that you just happen to have a big brain, so you like playing games.
So you think the people that have bigger brains, when they play the game the first time, they do better and they like it better?
That's right. Why would you play a game where you're constantly losing? That's really not much fun. So you may weed out people who have worse memory function or smaller brains.
Well, I mean, you know, maybe and some again, truth in that, because one game I refuse to play anymore is Trivial Pursuit. I find it interesting that you like that game, because I can't stand that game.
Well, I've lived through most of it, so I don't really have to. I don't have to read about it. All I got to do is remember what I was doing.
Yeah, well, good luck. Can you do that? I mean, me wow. playing Trivial Pursuit is a catastrophe.
Okay.
No, it is, unless we do the Lord of the Rings edition or something, you know, where I, you know, I actually have some knowledge.
All right, I think here's your problem. You have buried yourself in screens. You have learned all sorts of algorithms and data structures and all that sort of stuff. Maybe you should just get your head out of a screen and look around at the real world, and then Trivial Pursuit's going to come easy to you.
No, I don't
so
think
there.
So. Okay. I don't think so.
Well, never mind then.
I mean, you know. No, it's not going to happen.
Next up, this also was presented at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference in Copenhagen. This is Mia Kivipelto, and I'm just guessing on that pronunciation. The Karolinska Institute
She's probably not listening.
In Sweden, and also the National Institute for Health and Welfare, Helsinki, Finland, pointed out these results. This was a two-year, and this is what they called it, the Finnish Geriatric Intervention Study to Prevent Cognitive Impairment and Disability. Finnish Geriatric Intervention, they call that FINGER. Would you be a part of the FINGER study? That just doesn't sound good.
I don't know. I feel there's times driving down the road I think I've participated in that
FINGER study. The main aim of this was to reduce cognitive impairment. Again, they had 2 years, 1,200 people from six cities in Finland. They were ages 60 to 77. So the Wisconsin study looking at games was people age 60, average age. These were 60 to 77. And they looked at this intervention. And here's what they had. 7 group sessions on nutrition with 3 individual sessions. What are you eating? What should you be eating? What can you change? Next up, supervised exercise, and they increased muscle training from 1 to 2 times a week up to 2 to 4, and then aerobic training 2 to 4 went up to 5 to 6 times a week. So they were exercising vigorously, these 60 to 77 year olds. Computer-based cognitive training, and this could be something like Luminosity or something, some type of computer games. And then they had monitoring of vascular risk factors. That's high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and things like that, with a nurse visit every 3 months. The other people just got health advice and usual care. The people, even though they were doing all these interventions, there was a dropout rate of only 11%. 90% of the people actually completed it. 70% completed every single component, including the exercise intervention. At 2 years, there was a very significant beneficial effect of the intervention on their cognitive performance using, again, questionnaires and exams. Now, they're not able to see. Now, we got to be careful about this. It's great to have a bigger brain on an MRI scan. It's great to be able to fill out forms and solve riddles and puzzles in the laboratory.
Are you about to tell me that bigger isn't better?
Well, the question is really, does that, in fact, prevent Alzheimer's disease? And that's the thing that we don't know. On the other hand, it's pretty clear. Taking vitamins, B-complex vitamins and other vitamins, has never been shown to prevent Alzheimer's disease. Fish oil was promising but did not seem to pan out in the trials.
Just think of all those fish oil tablets you took.
Right, yeah. And I still take fish oil for other reasons, but I don't think it's going to protect my brain. The things that seem to make a difference are maintaining a normal weight, avoiding diabetes, and regular physical and mental exercise, and also association in groups, working with other people as you get older. Those seem to be the rock-solid ways that you can reduce your risk of Alzheimer's, and the results are pretty impressive. Unfortunately, a lot of people feel like Alzheimer's is inevitable. As you get older, there's nothing you can do, and that is simply not true. Unfortunately, we can't take a pill. Unfortunately, you can't have a surgery to prevent Alzheimer's disease in July of 2014, but what you can do is take care of your health, and that will pay off and help you prevent Alzheimer's disease. That's our sponsor, the Disease of the Month Club, Alzheimer's Disease, their motto, Alzheimer's Disease, what in the world is that motto again? Now, when we left our last fractional portion, we were talking about medical technology and their robot prostate surgery.
Right.
And just to remind you, this was published in the AMA Surgery Journal. They looked at records of 400,000 people who, between 2003 and 2009, had prostate surgery. 80% of them had the robot procedure. 20% had traditional prostate procedures. And it was the sort of thing where it really caught on. In 2003, there were 600 robotic prostatectomies in the U.S. By 2009, 37,000. So you can see how rapidly that thing built up. Now, what they found was, again, from 2003 to 2009, we did a lot of prostatectomies, and some of those prostate surgeries were done by robot. 2005, about the middle of that range, a person was nearly twice as likely to have a bad event at a teaching hospital using prostate robots as regular surgery.
Right.
Twice as likely to have some adverse event. Then,
so you, yeah, okay.
A year later, 10% of all prostate surgeries were being done by robot, and the complication rate went down. Out in the private sector, 2007, same thing happened. Rates were doubled of adverse events, and in 2008, the percentage of prostate surgeries exceeded 10%, and the complication rate went down. So what they think, and I think this is an overreach, but this is what they said about their surgery. Any new technology, when it first comes out, there is going to be a learning curve, which is obvious. The surgeons don't know this technology as well as other technologies. If you allow people to go through that learning curve, then your complication rates go down, and they understand the technology.
And they use it appropriately.
Right. And so our problem is, if we decide to shut things down too quickly. We say, oh, this robot, it's no good. It's causing too many complications. We need to get it off the market. We miss that second phase where people understand how to use it properly, and they and the complication rates go down.
See, isn't it a good thing, Tony, that they let Health Matters stay on the air all this time? We got through those bumpy times back in the early days. And now, look at us now. How much better are we?
We crossed that 10% barrier, and all of a sudden we're not nearly as catastrophic. I don't know. Or maybe we're about to. Maybe this is the argument for giving us another year. In another year, we'll actually know what we're doing on the show. But back to the surgeons, you know, I've got some problems with it. First of all, the way the Da Vinci robot was introduced, with all the quotas, with all the marketing, and with all the pressure sales tactics, and again, they gave these hospitals a $1.6 to $2 million piece of equipment. There was no way to pay for it except to do a whole bunch of surgeries. And so the hospital, looking at the bottom line, they were encouraging the surgeons to use it where it may not be the best option because they had to pay for the prostate surgery. Meanwhile, they got billboards up on the expressway pointing out that they are the ones that have the robot, and people were not aware that they were learning how to use the robot. So it's really frustrating. The other thing, it'd certainly be frustrating if you or someone you loved had a complication while a surgeon was trying to learn a new surgical technique. Society marches forward. In the end, it's a good thing, but tell that to the people who had the complications.
Yeah, I think the same thing, you know, Tony, and while I have no empirical evidence to support this, but I do know working in the industry, working in the equipment, back in the early 90s when laparoscopies just came out.
Again, this is using the scope for surgery,
right?
Instead of
we
using
use a scope to go in and we make three or four very small incisions, we inflate the abdomen. And then at the beginning, they were taking out just gallbladders. You know, now, look at all the things we do with laparoscopy. Look how much that's changed. But in those early days, I'm sure there was extra complications. I'm sure, you know, it was harder to work with those tools in a cavity through, you know, through a video scope, as opposed to actually reaching your hands in and doing the work.
Right. And it's, the odd thing is, I think people have this sort of schizophrenia about technology versus people. You have a person that comes in the hospital, and we are a teaching hospital at St. Clair, and there are teaching hospitals across the country. And how many times have you heard this, Rick? The person says, well, look, I don't want any young beginner surgeon operating on me. I want a very experienced surgeon. I don't keep the students and the learners away, even
right.
though we're all learning all the time. But in the same breath, people will say, but I want that new robot. I want lasers. I want you to use the lasers,
right.
And so forth. People are in love, infatuated with new technology, but they want the most experienced people. They don't seem to realize that the technology can render an experienced surgeon basically the same as as a new beginner, because this is not the way they learn to do the surgery. So, again, a word of caution. Don't be the first to jump in on a new technology unless you understand the risk of it. And then secondly, we as a society also have to not shut down promising technologies while we are learning to use them, because the benefits now of robotic procedures could actually have been missed had we not gone through that period of time. And I will tell you, there are people who still argue, and they have decent factual information that we're not still at that point where robots are beneficial.
No, Tony, and I think you know where I always thought we'd see robots first is in things like shuttle missions, you know, the space station, you know, places like we've seen where there's just a remote location you can't get to, but yet you need to have a small contingent of people there, and you may not have enough to support having an actual, you know, cardiothoracic surgeon on staff in the Antarctic. So, I mean, you know, there are these remote opportunities that you see the surgeries, and I think that's where we will see it kind of make
Ricky,
its mark.
You are such a dreamer. I mean, are such a dreamer. You have a multi-million-dollar new technology, and the first thing you do is you deploy it at the very far ends of the earth in these areas where there was no competition. I mean, if these companies develop this, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to set one right down in the middle of the suburbs and try to make as much money as possible.
Well,
I understand that.
There's a difference in what we're saying, Tony. I'm talking about proving the technology works. You're talking about using it in mass medicine. You know, I'm talking about where did oxygen concentrators come from that provide oxygen to millions of patients with COPD? Well, they developed that technology for a space mission so that they could regenerate oxygen out of the air. So I'm saying we use these needy situations to create the technology and prove it'll work. Then comes your part where we put it into the mass medicine. And as long as we put it in with the right techniques, with the right training, we're going to continue going down a good road.
Last thing. It
won't be a catastrophe.
Last thing before we go. This is about that hepatitis C medication called Sovaldi, and this came from the Gilead company. And this is the one we've talked about them before. This costs $1,000 a pill, $84,000 for a course of therapy to treat hepatitis C. Hepatitis C, the most common cause of liver transplants in the United States. So if we could treat it and cure it, and this is a very, very good drug, this would be a huge improvement in our nation's health. The problem is at $1,000 a pill, $84,000 for a treatment. Some people with resistant to hepatitis would have to get a twice as long, a double course, basically $160,000+ worth of drugs.
And I think we're finding that the math may not work out, right? I mean, the $84,000 may not.
Well, this is the interesting thing. There is a Senate committee. This is Ron Wyden of Oregon and Chuck Grassley of Iowa sent a letter to the head honcho of John Martin, who's the CEO of Gilead Sciences. And they pointed out it costs $84,000 for a course of treatment in the U.S. In Egypt, the same treatment, $900.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, that is a 99% discount. They pointed out that if this drug alone could increase Medicare spending on prescription drugs by $2 billion in the next year, if just 25,000 patients enrolled in their program, premium for Part D enrollees in Medicare would jump 8%. One-third of the total cases of hepatitis in the U.S. are in prison. American taxpayers could end up paying billions of dollars for their drug. And they asked them, explain to this Senate committee why you are charging so much for this drug. Stay tuned for this. We hope there will be some sense come of this, but
could be a catastrophe either way.
Absolutely. Speaking of catastrophes, can you help us escape from this show?
Special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producer Spencer Johnson and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
Health Matters is a once-a-day prescription radio show that is used with other shows to treat hepatitis C infection in adults. Health Matters should not be listened to alone. It is not known if Health Matters is safe and effective in children under 18 years of age.
Health Matters combination therapy can cause birth defects or the death of an unborn baby. If you or your sexual partner is pregnant or plans to become pregnant, do not listen to our show. If you or your partner can become pregnant, you must have a pregnancy test before listening to Health Matters every month while listening. Yeah, it is. And for 6 months after you stop listening to our show.
Tell your healthcare provider right away if a pregnancy occurs during or 6 months after you listen to Health Matters.
Before listening to Health Matters, tell your healthcare provider if you've had a liver transplant. That would be handy for them to know. If you're on kidney dialysis or if you have other medical conditions, you and your healthcare provider should decide if you will listen to Health Matters or breastfeed, because you should not do both.
You should not listen to Health Matters alone. I thought I said that before. Health Matters should not be used together with the front page or a time for tales to treat chronic hepatitis C infection.
It's the combination, see, Rick. Tell your healthcare provider about all medications you take, including prescription and over-the-counter medicines, vitamins, and herbal supplements. Other medicines may affect how Health Matters works.
For Health Matters used in combination with other shows, side effects including tiredness and headache and nausea, difficulty sleeping, and low red blood cell count.
Whatever you do, do not take health matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life. Attend the conference center, the Morehead Conference Center, August 6th from 10 to 2 p.m. We've got CDC Director Thomas Frieden visiting. And also tune in next week for our exciting series on the health benefits of procrastination on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.